House State Affairs Committee can now come to order. The time is 3:17 on Tuesday, April 29th, 2025, here in room 120. Please remember to silence your cell phones. Members present today include Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Moore, Representative Himshute, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, or is actually Zachary Lorne, and our record secretary is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator today is Zachary Lawhorn. Our committee aide is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all for helping us today. On today's agenda, we do have four bills. We'll start by taking public testimony on House Joint Resolution 10 from Representative Schrocki's office on a constitutional POMV. Next, we have consideration of amendments on HCR 2, a uniform rules abstention change from Representative Mears. Then we have an introductory hearing on House Bill 170 on failure to report a crime, also known as Kathleen's Law, by Representative Burke. And finally, an introductory hearing on House Bill 1, Gold and Silver Specie, from Representative McCabe. I'll also note that Representative Holland has just joined us. The first item on today's agenda is public testimony on HJR 10 on constitutionalizing the POMV. Before we get into public testimony, is there any additional discussion at this time on the resolution? Seeing none, I would just note for committee members that I had intended for the Permanent Fund Corporation to come back before us, but Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Frampton are on a plane right now, so they're not available. But we will have them back before us in committee on Thursday when we do bring the resolution back up. And so seeing no further discussion, I'll open public testimony on House Joint Resolution 10. It appears we have a couple of folks online. We'll start with them. Venetia Bingham and Juno, if you'd like to state your name and affiliation for the record. And testimony today will be limited due to our full calendar to 3 minutes.
Hi, my name is Venetia Bingham, and I am a Juneau resident. I've been an Alaska resident for 30 years, and I have thoughts on this are I think that there are other means for the legislature to come up with the funding. I don't think that making it the Constitution is the way to go on this. I think there are other avenues to go down, and that's just what I wanted to say.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Bingham, and thank you for calling in to testify today. Next, we have Teresa Obermeyer in Anchorage.
Good afternoon. Teresa Obermeyer from Anchorage. I feel such failure when I see like things like this about the Alaska Permanent Fund Board that is not even confirmed by the legislature. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Representative, can you hear? You can hear me? Okay, because you see, I spent from 2001 until 2015 posting online at a website I created the signatures of the past Permanent Fund Board and staff and their astronomical investments in the stock market. I did have to stop because I had to pay for my children's education. And here, 10, and would you forgive me? I got almost 24,000 hits. And yet no one checks the Permanent Fund Board and what they do. And it's like supposed to be the sacred cow. I simply don't understand why this has not been reviewed over these many years. And I certainly wouldn't support SJR 14 or HJR 10 under any circumstances, giving them more power and authority. I assume you know that the Permanent Fund Board is only a gubernatorial appointment, and it should be confirmed by those people who are in public office, you whom I respect. Instead, you are under their feet, practically. I simply don't understand why this hasn't been researched more. So what I've done now, I finally decided, I asked Mr. Mitchell if he would start again giving me their individual investment transaction disclosures. And I am trying to start this, and I'll probably put it on Facebook. I'm hoping he's going to do it because I already did it for 14 years. And he will send me their signatures. I will post them every month. I don't even want to put a value on that. I want us to check how much money they're investing in the stock market that you let them do. If you'll forgive me, anywhere else in the United States, this could be labeled insider trading. Here, it's perfectly normal, and you continue to let them. Please do not support HJR10. Thank you for hearing me. If anybody had a question, I'd be glad to field them.
Thank you, Ms. Obermeyer, and I appreciate you calling in today to testify. I see no other public testimony online, so we'll look to the room. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to testify on House Joint Resolution 10? Seeing no one in the room and nobody else online, at this time I'm going to close public testimony on HJR 10. And seeing no further discussion, we are going to set HJR 10 aside. As a reminder to committee members, at our previous committee hearing, I set an amendment deadline for HJR 10 for this Wednesday, as in tomorrow, April 30th at 5 p.m. Please get any amendments to my office by that time. So at this time, we're setting House Joint Resolution 10 aside, and we'll move on to House Concurrent Resolution 2 on a uniform rules abstention from Representative Muir's office. At our previous hearing, I set an amendment deadline for HCR 2 of Monday, April 28 at 5 p.m., and we received no amendments by that time. Is there any additional discussion on HCR 2? Seeing none, and seeing no further discussion, I will turn to Vice Chair Story. Do you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move HCR 2, also known as 34-LS0342/A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And seeing no objection, HCR 2 is moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. At ease. House State Affairs Committee is back on record, and for the record, I just wanted to note that Representative Story joined us at 3:19 p.m. Just a little while ago. So at this time, we will move on to our next item on the agenda, House Bill 170 on failure to report a crime from Representative Burke. Today, we'll have an introductory presentation from Representative Burke and her staff, and then two invited testifiers. I'll also just note for committee members that we have the following staff available from Department of Law and Department of Public Safety. We have John Skidmore, our Deputy Attorney General in the Department of Law. And joining us in the room today is the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Welcome to Commissioner Cockrell. So, Representative Burke, if you'd like to come up to the dais and put your names on the record, the presentation is before us, so you can begin.
Chair Carrick, and members of House State Affairs. For the record, my name is Robin Nate Burke. I'm representative for District 40, representing the North Slope and Northwest Arctic regions. Thank you for allowing me to present House Bill 170 today. House Bill 170 seeks to increase the penalty for not reporting a violent crime on an adult from a violation to a Class B misdemeanor. I think we're going to start off with the sectional analysis. I think it's on the next slide. Okay. And I will, joining me here is my chief of staff, Lucretia Wilson. Lucretia.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. For the record, Lucretia Wilson, staff to Representative Burke. Sectional analysis. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 1156-767-D, changing failing to report a crime from a violation to a Class B misdemeanor. Section 2 adds an applicability clause as amended by Section 1 of this act, which applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date of this act. This means the state cannot retroactively charge a defendant.
Thank you.
Alaska's violent crime rate has remained consistently above the national average for more than four decades, including in rural areas. Just stay on slide. Okay. Violent crimes consist of murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, attempted kidnapping, sexual penetration, attempted sexual penetration. Kathleen Jo Henry joins a long list of women who have lost their lives due to a violent crime. Kathleen was sexually assaulted and murdered in 2019. Her killer showed her dead body to another individual who failed to report the crime. This suspect remains free today. Currently, not reporting a violent crime on an adult is a violation, punishable with a fine of up to $500. House Bill 170 would increase the current penalty to a Class B misdemeanor, punishable with a jail sentence up to 90 days and a maximum fine of $2,000. With a higher penalty for perpetrators, this bill would empower victims and survivors alike to report a crime, possibly before escalating to death. The Urban Indian Health Institute attempted to collect data in 71 cities across 29 states, highlighting the missing murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis. Due to challenges in collecting data on historical cases, approximately 80% of the cases in their report occurred since 2000. There's a lack of quality data due to underreporting and racial misclassification, among other reasons. Yuhi collected data in Alaska from Utqiagvik, Fairbanks, Bethel, Anchorage, Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan. In 2024, the Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission found that many victims felt they were not taken seriously by people in the criminal justice system. However, early prevention, awareness, measures, and financial compensation are available for victims, including but not limited to Victim Witness Assistance and Victim Navigator Program. The Alaska Native Public Safety Officers Don't Wait campaign has worked diligently to inform the public that one does not have to wait 24 hours to report someone missing or who may be in danger. I want to thank the committee again for hearing this bill today. Please join me in supporting House Bill 170.
And committee questions and discussion. We can also go to our invited testifiers at this time and take questions at the end. That might be a good place to start. So first up for invited testimony, we have Antonia Kalmak. And okay. All right, so it sounds like we have Amber Nickerson first. Thank you for joining House State Affairs. Please keep your testimony to 5 or so minutes. Okay.
Okay, Chairperson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for me to speak today. My name is Amber Nickerson. So under the current language, Alaska Statute 11.56.767, the failure to report a violent crime against an adult, a person who witnesses or has knowledge of a murder, kidnapping, or sexual assault is not mandated to report it. So there are by strengthening the statute, we can give police and investigators a meaningful tool to pursue individuals who conceal knowledge of serious crimes. People who had already come forward and report these crimes will not be affected by strengthening this law. They are already doing the right thing. This change targets those who choose to stay silent because they have something to hide. People who obstruct justice, protect offenders, or allow violent crimes to go unpunished. The weakness in the statute was exposed in the case involving Ian Calhoun and Brian Stephen Smith. Even Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore acknowledged in a commentary to the Alaska Beacon, under Alaska law, there is no general duty for citizens to report a crime or to aid law enforcement or the criminal justice system. That is unacceptable. It seems that putting time and resources into investigating a violation isn't feasible. Making this a Class B misdemeanor means law enforcement can treat these cases with the seriousness they deserve. As 11.56767 must be strengthened to alleviate the failure to report a violent crime against an adult. Alaska deserves better. Our laws must match the seriousness of violent crimes and the importance of protecting victims and our community. When I was researching on other states that have these different misdemeanors and charges for this, Ohio and Texas have similar. I have emailed the committee and I've spoke to most of the people on this committee as well. Thank you. I will email my statement, and I'm available for questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Nickerson. And if you wanted to stay in the room for potential questions.
Sure.
So next we'll go to Antonia Comack. Thank you for joining us. If you want to put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good afternoon, State Affairs. My name is Antonia Onuxet Comack. I am Inupiaq and my family is from Shungnak. I have been a missing and murdered Indigenous people's advocate for many years. My advocacy started in 2017 when my best friend and cousin, Robin Gray, was murdered by her partner in front of their young children. Then our other best friend, Kristen Huntington, was violently beaten, murdered, and stuffed into a vacant apartment closet by her partner in 2020. They searched for her for days before finding her. This is the reality for many Alaska Natives today. But I'm not here to advocate only for the safety of Alaska Natives. HB 170, sponsored by Representative Robin Nyack-Burke, is a bill that will increase the safety for all Alaskans. As my friend Amber just told you guys, we've already had one person avoid being held accountable for failure to report a violent crime committed against an adult in Ian Calhoun's case. She told you guys that John Skidmore, who is the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska, wrote about this in the Alaska Beacon only after we held many protests to raise awareness. Not only has Ian Calhoun's actions been acknowledged by the Deputy Attorney General, but the state's prosecutor, Brittany Dunlop, said this in the murderer's sentencing memorandum. Brittany Dunlop wrote, "He," meaning the killer, Brian Smith, "bragged to Ian Calhoun about having fun," and that is a quote in her sentencing memorandum, "having fun the morning after torturing and killing Kathleen Jo Henry and likely showing Ian Calhoun her body in the back of his truck later that day. It is clear from the Facebook messages that Brian Smith made Ian Calhoun aware of where he dumped Kathleen Jo Henry's body. No remorse, no regret, only amusement." And that is a quote from her sentencing memorandum from Brittany Dunlop. She is acknowledging that Ian Calhoun had knowledge of these violent crimes committed by a serial killer in 2019, and yet he walks free amongst other citizens. His court view is completely clean. We have to ask ourselves why Ian Calhoun is not being charged with a crime. His friend was bragging to him about a murder and showed him her dead body. This man, Ian Calhoun, later notified the serial killer that Kathleen's body had been located by law enforcement a month later. That is intimate knowledge of a violent crime. There have been two cases that we know of where people were charged with failure to report a violent crime, and that was in the Jacqueline Goodwin murder case. She is also a murdered Indigenous woman. The murderer's brother and mother knew she was being murdered in the basement and did not notify police. Why is Ian Calhoun not being held accountable as well for the same crimes? We feel that this crime, as it is currently written with only a $500 fine for not reporting, is not enough for police to put their resources into investigating. Maybe if the consequences were higher than a $500 fine, law enforcement will take these cases seriously. We just want to give police the tools they need to hold these violent criminals accountable so no one slips through the cracks like Ian Calhoun has. Kathleen Jo Henry's family has given me permission to advocate on their behalf. They wanted me to tell you guys this about their loved one. They said, "Kathleen was tough. She had no fear for anything. She always made sure we weren't being bullied or being mistreated by others. She was always willing to help anybody with anything. She loved all of us in her own way. She never judged any of us and just loved us just the way we are." Another one of her family members said this, "I hope this law passes. She had such a big heart, too big for many, but not by the ones that she loved. She had so much love for the kids in her family and created names for each of them. Despite her shortcomings, she always rose up and continued on. She loved her family and was loved in return. She is missed." Kathleen's family has kept quiet and has been avoiding the media and do not want to talk about anybody about Kathleen's story because what happened to her is too painful for them to speak about. I want to leave you all with this thought. I want you all to imagine that your mother, your sister, your aunt, or your friend was kidnapped, violently sexually assaulted, tortured for hours, murdered, sexually assaulted again after death, put into a truck, and kept there for 2 days before being thrown on the side of the road like trash. All while all of this was happening, it was also being recorded and photos were being taken. That is what happened to Kathleen Jo Henry in 2019. There is a man who knew about all of these crimes and did not report it. HB 170 seeks to address this gap in our justice system. I am asking you to please swiftly move this out of state affairs and into judiciary so we can make our state safer for all Alaskans. Thank you very much, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And thank you so much for being here. So that concludes our invited testimony. I open it up to the committee for discussions and questions, if there are any. Representative Himshute.
Thank you, through the chair. It's always hard to hear about this kind of thing. So my question is for the bill sponsor. I'm not sure where I saw it. Maybe it was in the sponsor statement, but we, and through the chair, apologies. So the crime right now is considered a violation with a $500 fine, basically. By making it a Class B misdemeanor, what does that change?
Thank you for the question, through the chair, to Representative Himshute. By increasing the penalty to a Class B misdemeanor, it would be punishable with a jail sentence of up to 90 days and a maximum fine of $2,000.
Quick follow-up, through the chair, do you have a sense of how many, I don't know how this would be knowable, but how many of these are currently, there's probably no way to know this, but the idea is by making it a more serious offense, more effort will be put into finding the folks who are failing to report.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Himshute. Yes, I don't have a sense of how many I know of this particular case, and as Antonia spoke to the previous two cases, we do have John Skidmore in the room, and I think that by increasing the penalty, it'll put more energy behind investigating these types of cases, and that's the intent.
Okay, thanks.
So I'd like to put myself in the queue and maybe ask that question to Commissioner Cockrell about the frequency that we see this type of evidence in this type of crime. Thank you to the bill sponsor. Thank you, Commissioner, for joining us.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm James Cockrell. I'm the Commissioner of Alaska Department of Public Safety. And if you want to ask your question now, or you just want me to...
Yeah, I'll restate the question. So how frequently do we see failure to report a crime not being prosecuted, but just anecdotally, how frequently is that a part of an investigation? Just, I guess, anecdotally, before we ask Mr. Skidmore probably the same question.
Through the chair, we did a deep dive into our record management system and apps, and we can't find any recent cases where the Alaska State Troopers charged somebody for that, either violation or anything else.
And I guess as a follow-up, do you feel that that's because the penalty is a simple violation?
Through the chair, I think it's twofold. One, it is certainly a violation, and for law enforcement to spend a lot of time on it, that most likely they may not. Secondly, most likely, too, a lot of law enforcement officers may not know about the current law that we currently have on the books. So if we're not, if we don't have really good knowledge of it, the chances of us filing charges on someone on that type of crime is probably less likely. And that would be one of my recommendations on this bill if we go forward with it, is to ensure that the people of Alaska know if they don't report a crime to an adult. We certainly know about children, but not adults, that the information's out there. Because it's not only that we may get additional people turning in or providing valuable information on a felony level crime, but it also potentially reduce the number of charges that we put against a person. The department is not opposed to the bill. We've talked to the advocacy groups, and I haven't found anybody that's opposed to it. Well, the only concern is if it went any higher than a B misdemeanor. There's some concerns about that, but other than that, I haven't had any concerns about this bill. And essentially, it's a zero fiscal note for the department, and I'm not opposed to Representative Burke's bill.
Okay. Thank you for that. A few people in the queue. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. Hey, Commissioner.
Sir.
How are you?
Doing good, sir.
Through the chair. So I have a couple questions. So the first one is this going to help law enforcement, essentially? Is this a tool that you can use maybe to do your job, or your officers do their jobs a little bit more? In other words, you know, they can, if they're questioning the guy, they can say, hey, you know, this is a pretty serious crime if you don't report this.
Through the chair, it's certainly not going to hurt us to have a bill like this. Again, law enforcement and the general public need to actually know what the bill is, what it does, and how it does protect themselves if they know of a violent crime, and how they can report it to law enforcement. We certainly want folks to, or people regardless, to report felony level crimes against people, because as we've stated before, we have a high rate of violence in this state, and this is one way to try to deter it.
Thanks, and just one quick follow-up. So through the chair, Commissioner, and I know that your heart is with the missing, murdered, and indigenous people, just from previous testimony. But I'm wondering if there's a possibility, if we enact this, I'm kind of thinking of the law that we enacted about the slowdown pullover for troopers when you see the flashing red lights, and there was a big public push to get that out there in the public, I assume probably from a grant. So if there is, would there be a way to do that and get this into the public eye if we do enact this and maybe make a little bit of a TV spots or TV ads or something like that? I mean, is that something the troopers would be interested in pushing forward?
To the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't see any negatives on it. I do know that we have specific funding for outreaches for the MMIP initiative the department's running. We potentially could put it in there at one point in time. Again, it's the more information that's out there, the higher probability somebody will report a violent crime. And if the general public doesn't know they have to do it, realistically, it's not going to occur. And that's probably why we're not seeing it in our statistical analysis of the current law.
Thanks. And yeah, just one comment. I know that you had a list, a big spreadsheet, a list really long in a previous hearing of all the missing part of that MMIP. And I'm just wondering if we had a more intense law or some higher level, if it wouldn't be a reason for people to report it so they wouldn't be missing. I mean, just kind of tying together what I'm thinking, and maybe that's just a comment rather than a question. But
all right, through the chair, I'll try to answer that. We currently are through the VPSO program, because I see them as I know we're going into be part of things, but certainly see them as a major component in MMIP, because essentially they're the boots in the grounds in many of our villages where people go missing. We do have the Don't Wait 24-Hour campaign that we put on the radio. We've got a couple TV spots on, ensure that folks have a trip report. And so we're doing things to try to reduce the number of missing people that we have in the state, whether it's environmental or if it's by violence. And the department has been focused on that. Now, we talked about it today in tribal affairs for the last several years, and we're making progress. I know that in the PAT that you talk about, our victim navigators, certainly they've been a big part of because if you look at the Alaska Victimization Survey that was conducted by the University of Alaska for for the Council on Domestic Violence, one of the things that struck me reading that report is the fact that the victims just didn't feel like police understood or really cared for them. They just didn't feel good about it. And what we do know that is, especially in rural Alaska, if we do have, and I'll say usually females, but we want to keep in touch with our victims of violent crimes because it's real easy in rural Alaska to lose them. So with our navigators, we focus on trying to keep them in the system, understanding the system, and keeping them up to date with their cases. Because one thing troopers aren't very good at, and I was a trooper for many years, is we don't call back our victims because we're going on to the next case, the next case, the next case. The navigator program does a much better job of keeping that engagement and that connection with the department, and it's been very successful, and our troopers have really liked the program, especially our investigators that are investigating felony level crimes. I know I kind of went off.
That's okay. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I think Representative Holland, did you want to be in the queue? Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. And to the chair, and I'm not sure if this question is for the commissioner or perhaps the sponsor, but I'm just curious, the Class B misdemeanor on the surface strikes me as a what might be a fairly modest criminal level, but I'm not an expert on all the different levels of crimes to know how serious this might actually be. But I'm just curious if there's some background why Class B was chosen and what a higher level might have been and why it was chosen to be this level, just to help me understand the context of this being the right level, or is there a different level that should be considered?
Through the chair, I'm going to use my lifeline, the Deputy Attorney General Skidmore. He's much versed on that. I do know through the advocacy groups there's a point that they don't want to go above because they're afraid people will not provide the information, and that's why I think they settled on Class B. But I'll let the if that's all right with you, Chair, let Skidmore come up.
In just a moment, I'd like to bring up Deputy Attorney General Skidmore and the bill sponsor. If we could just hold that question for a moment. Representative Himshut, do you have a question for Commissioner Cockerell?
Thanks, through the chair. Just how does one, and this is probably a very basic question, Commissioner, how does one prove a case like this? What kind of evidence? And I don't think that impacts whether or not I support the legislation. I'm just curious. There's no greater burden on your staff by changing what happens through the courts. So the evidence that you use is going to be the same no matter what.
I see what you're saying, but the purpose of this bill to stop violence from happening prior to the violence happening. Is essentially what we do. It'd be investigative. You know, as we're investigating sexual assault or homicide or serious felony level crime, we're going to start interviewing people. Eventually, as we interview people, we're going to start tracking those people that's peripherally outside maybe the case but still connected to the investigation. And at some point in time, we're going to find out if he or she knew about it and didn't report it to law enforcement or to the Alaska State Troopers. I mean, are we going to get all of them or not? But that's essentially either that or somebody's going to, one of their buddies or somebody is going to talk, or they're going to put it on Facebook. We're going to find out about it one way or another. There's going to be instances we'll never find out about it. But generally speaking, on those type of crimes, people talk, and that's how we end up making the cases.
Quick follow-up.
Thanks. Through the chair, I guess I'm just concerned about this having the opposite effect of somebody who sees something knowing, the consequence to me, if I don't report it is higher. So I'm going to be more motivated to report it. Not, like, people may not realize that it's a crime already to not report it. So if we draw attention to that, yeah. Anyway, it's
Okay.
And I will say that most people aren't going to understand if it's a misdemeanor or a Class A misdemeanor, Class B or Class C felony. They're just going to know that they're required by law to report it. And that's the real, regardless what class we're talking about, realistically what we want people to do is report crimes, and they know that if they don't report crimes on an adult, they potentially might get charged themselves regardless, because they're not going to understand the nuance of the actual charges. Just the fact that the message out there is that if you don't report a crime, a violent crime, that you could go to jail, which we can on the Class B misdemeanor, but they don't know that, generally speaking. I mean, they don't know when they do a sexual assault, if it's a Class A class, they're just going to do the crime, right? So okay. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Did I have Representative Story and Representative Vance in the queue? Would you like to ask a question of Commissioner Cockerell? Vice Chair Story.
Sure. Thank you, through the chair. I think, you know, education is really important. And so I just see it key that your department, and we'll have to have a, and we should have a campaign anyway, because it's very serious. I think that part of it, my question is, just like anything, I think some people, when they see something, they can be very shocked and very afraid that someone is going to harm them if they say something. And I just know there's assurances in law that if you report something, it's anonymous, and you can ask for protection if you are concerned about that, and I just wanted those assurances. And I would think any kind of public awareness campaign should be saying you can report anonymously, and just want those assurances.
Certainly law enforcement receives anonymous tips all the time. I do say there is a safety net in the regulation or in the statute. I can let the Skidmore talk about the fact that if you do, or if you're put in fear that you don't, and the chances of it coming back to you, you don't have to report the crime. So there is a catch there, and I'll let the deputy attorney general, he's a lawyer, I'm not, so if that's okay with you.
Commissioner Cockerell, if you could stay in the room, we will potentially bring you back up for additional questions. At this time, I'd like to go back to Representative Holland's question and ask that the bill sponsor and our Deputy Attorney General come forward. And Representative Holland, do you want to restate your question again?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Clarification and just information I was interested in was the selection of the Class B misdemeanor as the new level of, or class of this crime, and what might have been the higher or lower levels to help me just understand the context of this being the class that's being proposed in this legislation.
We can start with the bill sponsor.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Holland. We did have a few different iterations of this bill with different levels. Currently, failure to report a crime against a child, I believe, is a Class A misdemeanor. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so we toggled with things a little bit, and ultimately, as Commissioner Cockerell said, we decided on a level of crime that we felt wouldn't hinder, I suppose, hinder people. And just for clarification, the purpose of House Bill 170 is to be, you know, an investigative tool, and very specifically for in referencing Alaska Statute, 11.56 at 767. For crimes of murder, kidnapping, and sexual penetration. So just wanted to make that clarification as well. And we did speak with several people, including Deputy Attorney General
Okay, all right. Sorry. Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore about the level. And this is one that there's a companion bill on the in the Senate side, and we worked together and decided on the Class B misdemeanor.
Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you. Good to have you back. I have questions about this, and one area that we can look to is our mandatory reporting for children has been addressed. And so what this bill would do is essentially make everyone a mandatory reporter when it came to these high-level crimes. Is that a simple way of looking at it?
I think that's a question for me. Through the chair,
I apologize.
This is John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General, for the record. Through the chair to Representative Vance, the statute that's currently on the books says that it is a violation if the person witnesses what they reasonably should have known. I will tell you, I think there may be some challenges to that. I wouldn't say that it was anything. One of the examples that we heard earlier was someone that had seen a body in a vehicle. Is that the actual murder of the body? No, that's not. Does that mean that they've witnessed the murder? I think would be the subject of litigation, quite frankly. So when you say, does that mean that anyone is required to report a crime of which they have information, I think that's probably too broad. I think what it does do is it says if you come across someone where the act is in process, that would be the witnessing of it, and that would be required to report it. I can tell you that we have any number of cases in which we have had individuals that actually observe a sexual assault against someone that is incapacitated at the time that's occurring. And so what this bill would require is that you either A, report it to law enforcement, B, you're aware that it's already reported and therefore you don't have a duty to do anything, or C, that you are required to intervene and stop the act from occurring. And if you are successful in doing that, then you're not required to report anything beyond that. That's the way the statute's currently drifted. And all that the bill in front of you does is it changes the penalty from a violation to a Class B misdemeanor.
Thank you for that. I'm reading through the statute and trying to understand when it comes to what we already have is known and mandatory reporting mm-hmm. for children. It's a very thorough area of statute as compared to this area that like you said, it's not as specific to what the stories that was described in earlier testimony. And for this specific statute, what type of immunity is available to people for failure to report?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, John Skidmore again. If someone has witnessed a crime and they have not reported it immediately and don't fall into one of the exceptions that are also found in the statute, and I believe there are three of those as well, if you don't fall into one of those exceptions, then in order to have that person's testimony provided at trial, the state would be obligated to request the court order immunity or for the state itself to grant immunity to that individual in order to compel them to testify. Otherwise, they would have what's called the Fifth Amendment privilege. That's the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. There is also a similar privilege within the Alaska Constitution that says someone could not be compelled to testify when that evidence would be evidence of them having committed a crime themselves. So not about the homicide, but rather about not having reported and yet you knew something about it or had witnessed it, I should say, to be very clear. And so in those instances, we would have to grant immunity. Back to a question from Representative Holland earlier, when this statute was originally enacted in 2008, it was originally proposed to be a Class C felony as opposed to a B misdemeanor, or the violation that it is today. And at that time, there was testimony in the Senate that talked about those issues with immunity. We're still evaluating whether immunity would pose problems for us or not. I don't have that answer for you today because we're still evaluating it. But I can tell you that there was testimony about that in 2008, and the result was they decided to make it a violation at that time. to avoid the immunity issues.
Follow up. What's the time frame that someone has within the law for reporting? Because, I mean, clearly this is would elevate that. It's a crime, but it would elevate it to being on their record. What's the time frame that is considered reasonable to report before it is officially something that you would prosecute?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, the statute speaks of a reasonable period of time. It does not provide a particular number of minutes or hours or seconds. It just says reasonable, and that would have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
Follow-up? My next question is going to be, you have vast experience in this, and clearly we want people to be reporting these awful crimes. But
sure.
There's people who would be fearful that this is enacting a nanny state of saying, hey, you know, we're gonna prosecute you and make you a criminal, that possible jail time if you fail to report something. What do you say to people who are concerned about that aspect that could be considered government overreach?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I really think that's a policy decision for the legislature to be making about whether or not this is the type of conduct that you all think should be criminalized, or whether it's you would rather leave it as the violation that it currently is. I think that the two sides of the debate are sort of as you have already described. On the one hand, you'll have some people that argue that would make it a nanny state. And on the other hand, I think you'll have the people that will argue that there is a moral social contract that we have to one another as human beings that says that we should be reporting those things. What do you do when that doesn't happen? That's the fundamental question at the heart of this particular piece of legislation. And that's one that you all would have to decide. And I'm not really the right person to answer that question.
Come on. You give me a political answer. I was hoping you'd help me out. Throw me a line. Thank you. This is, I mean, clearly Alaska has, we've considered any crimes against children that is not reported. That is serious business. But we also have, we should not see it any less serious when these awful crimes are happening against our vulnerable adults. And I think that's what this bill seeks to address. But is there any more insight that you can give us in how this particular area of statute can help you in prosecution? Because I think what I heard from the testimony is that they want to get to the accountability and help give you as the prosecutors the tools to bring justice. And it, to me, it feels like this area of statute is still very vague. Is there any recommendations that you have that would help you give the tools that the community is seeking?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I'm afraid I don't have any recommendations for how to amend or alter the bill that's in front of you. I think that there are policy questions, as I've already articulated, that the legislature has to grapple with. Do they want to make it a crime, or do they think the violation is the appropriate way to address it? Certainly, we want to encourage all people to report crimes. That's without question. Everyone has that same goal. Whether this accomplishes that or not is something I have to leave to your all's discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you. And additional discussion or questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Himshute.
This is for Deputy Commissioner, Deputy Director.
Deputy Attorney General, ma'am.
Deputy Attorney General. Thank you, Skidmore. Or maybe the bill sponsor. I just recall Representative Burke saying murder, kidnapping, sexual penetration. So are there other violent crimes, like if someone is beaten, is that considered a violent crime, and would that be covered here as well then?
You want me to do that, or did you want to do that?
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Himshute, Representative Robin Burke, for the record. In going through the statute, I apologize, I don't have the statute directly in front of me. So it says, witnesses what the person knows or reasonably should know is the murder or attempted murder of a person by another, the kidnapping or attempted kidnapping of a person by another, or the sexual penetration or attempted sexual penetration by another, of a person without consent of the person, of a person who is mentally incapable, of a person who is incapacitated, or of a person who is unaware that a sexual act is being committed and does not, as soon as reasonably practicable, report that crime to a peace officer or law enforcement agency.
Quick follow-up. It also specifies an adult. Is there a whole separate section of statute then for children?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional questions? I have one for the Deputy Attorney General. I apologize if this was just answered. Is attempted murder in that list of violent crimes? Okay.
Yes.
I think you just answered that. Sorry about that. Okay. Any additional questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, we are going to set House Bill 170 aside for a future hearing today. We will try to bring this bill up under bills previously heard on Thursday, but at this time we are setting HB 170 aside. And we're going to take a brief at ease to get set up for our last item on today's agenda, House Bill 1. At ease. First committee is back on the record. At this time, we'll take up House Bill 1 for its introductory hearing on gold and silver specie from Representative McCabe. I'll allow you both to give a presentation of the bill, go through the sectional, and then we do have invited testimony today as well. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Carrick and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Kevin McCabe, and I represent District 30, the best district in the state of Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity to present House Bill 1. It's a bill rooted in Alaska's constitutional authority and focused on protecting the financial freedom of everyday Alaskans. With me today are my staff, Angela Steffel and Julie Morris. Julie's online and available to provide the sectional analysis if the committee would like to read that into the record. HB 1 recognizes gold and silver specie as legal tender in Alaska under Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution, as well as the 10th Amendment. It secures the rights of Alaskans under the 9th and 10th Amendments to tender gold and silver in the payment of debts where accepted. It brings Alaska into full compliance with the U.S. Constitution by aligning state policy with the treatment of gold and silver as specie and specie as legal tender. It prohibits boroughs and municipalities from taxing precious metal exchanges when used as currency for transaction, and which is currently occurring in some areas. It protects specie from use or exchange taxes, which prevents double taxation. To be clear, a person will still have to pay the sales tax, if applicable, on their purchase using specie. This bill only addresses any sales tax on the purchase and use of the specie itself. It clarifies that no one is required to use specie. This is about freedom of choice, not mandates. Keep in mind also that the seller and the buyer must agree. So the merchant that is going to accept the specie must agree to do it. He cannot be forced to do it. It prepares for prepares us for the future by granting the legislative budget and audit committees the powers to explore tools like state-held gold reserves or repositories. HB 1 matters because it asserts state sovereignty and reclaims the powers that have long gone unused. It protects Alaskans from inflation, especially seniors, wage earners, and small savers, those hardest hit by a devaluing dollar. It corrects a fundamental unfairness. We don't tax stocks or bonds, so we shouldn't penalize those who choose to save in gold or silver. It reinforces Alaska's leadership in a growing national movement towards sound money policy. National momentum is moving pretty quickly in this arena, and there's new updates as of this week. HB 1 reaffirms gold and silver as legal tender in Alaska and ends local level taxes on specie, keeping Alaska at the forefront of the national sound money movement. Alaska would become the 7th state to reaffirm gold and silver as legal tender, joining Wyoming, Utah, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Alabama. Also, 46 states have now eliminated sales taxes on gold and silver, with 9 states acting in just the last 4 years. 14 states have ended capital gains taxes on precious metals, including Idaho this year. Momentum is building, with several more considering legislation. As you can see, this is a growing bipartisan national trend, with legislative wins in 5 states already secured in 2025 and active bills moving in Alaska, Florida, Indiana, Missouri, and Tennessee. HB 1 reaffirms gold and silver as legal tender in Alaska and ensures that cities, boroughs, and municipalities can't impose legal sales taxes on these transactions. This closes a loophole left by Alaska's lack of a state sales tax and fully aligns Alaska with the national sound money movement, as I said. The Alaska Municipal League has voiced concerns about the potential revenue loss, but keep in mind that Alaska does not track precious metal sales separately, making the actual impact unknown. It's likely very minimal, considering the research we did. We went to New Hampshire and like-sized states to try to determine how much sales tax they might have lost from not taxing gold and silver. And in our estimation, it's less than $27,000 in Alaska that combined in aggregate that any cities that have sales taxes would lose. HB 1 won't fix the Federal Reserve, but it gives Alaskans a tool to fight back. It restores constitutional fidelity, provides financial resilience, and ends unjust local taxation. It protects small savers, empowers choice, and asserts Alaska's leadership in this monetary policy. It will preserve, protect, and promote the state's economic security and the welfare of its people while affirming their right to use sound money in everyday transaction. So, sort of in closing of the opening statement here, I consider this to be a portable way to store value. So we all know as the inflation hits and as the dollar starts to be devalued, the best place to store value is to buy property or land, right? I mean, that's historically where you can maintain the value of your money. But when you go to buy a loaf of bread, you can't turn your land in or sell your land for a loaf of bread. This allows the small savers that can't afford to buy land to store the value in their safe instead of storing greenbacks, which are devaluating with inflation. The gold tends to keep its value with respect to all other goods in the United States. So a small saver that can only afford a couple $100 a month or maybe even less than that could purchase these on a rotating basis, keep them in his safe, and have a store of value right there in his house. So with that, Julie's available to read the sectional if you'd like, and we do have invited testimony. I think J.P. Cortez is online for us. So
let's go ahead and read the sectional for this legislation. Ms. Morris, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and walk through the sectional.
Good afternoon, Chair Carrick and Vice Chair Story, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Thank you.
Yes. For the record, I'm Julie Morris, staff to Representative Kevin McCabe. The sectional for HB 1, establishing species as a legal tender and exempting it from local taxes, is as follows. Section 1 and 2 amends AS 2910-200 to prohibit boroughs and cities from imposing sales and use taxes on specie. Through the addition of new subsections in M and I, this prevents local governments from taxing gold and silver purchases or exchanges. Section 3 updates AS 2945-650A to include a prohibition on taxing species for boroughs. This reinforces the intent that species, as legal tender, should not be subject to local taxation at the borough level. Section 4 adds AS 2945-650M, specifically banning boroughs from taxing species transactions. This extends the prohibition to all municipalities, ensuring uniformity across the state. Section 5 amends AS 2945-700A to align city taxation with the borough restrictions in Section 4. This ensures that cities follow the same rules for specie taxation as boroughs.
in section 6, adds AS 2945-700A, explicitly prohibiting cities from taxing specie. This further solidifies that all municipalities, regardless of their local governance, cannot impose taxes on the exchange or sale of gold and silver. Section 7 creates AS 4412-400, designating specie, gold and silver coins or bullion, as legal tender. This includes coins issued by the U.S. or recognized foreign governments and any state-approved specie if authorized. This section does not mandate the acceptance of species, but gives the authority to recognize species as valid currency. Additionally, it directs the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to study the potential of expanding the legal tender options. That brings this sectional to a close. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Morris. Representative McCabe.
Okay, so just to clarify one thing, because it's a little bit confusing, this is only concerning the purchase of these. This is called specie. It's just like a gold coin. That's all this does. If you use these for a transaction to buy a gallon of milk, the tax or whatever you buy in a city, the tax is still there. You still pay the city tax on that purchase. So really, this is only for the initial purchase of these or of a gold coin. So think of it this way. If you take two $50 bills and go down to the store and say, I'd like to trade these in for a $100 bill, you don't pay a tax on that $100 bill. Currently, you would pay a tax on these, say, in Wasilla. All we are trying to do is to get these to be equal when they are used as legal tender. So, or when they are, when the price is virtually the same. I add in another example. I have a sheet of $2 bills. There's five or six of them. Right now, as a collectible, they're worth about $50. But if I cut them up and use them in the, provided I could find somebody that understands what a $2 bill is, but if I used them to purchase something, then they would only be worth, $12 or $10, whatever it is. So if I buy and sell them as a collectible, as a numismatic, then I would owe a tax on them. Right, because I'm using them for more than, or selling them for more than the value. But if I use them as a $2 bill or buy them, trade two ones in for a $2 bill, then I wouldn't pay a tax in them. So it's a little bit nuanced. It's a little bit confusing in here, but it only is for these, for the buying and selling of these to relieve the tax on the specie. So, and JP is on the line as well.
Yeah, let's go to invited testimony since we do have a couple folks available. And looks like we have just the one invited testifier. So JP Cortez, Mr. Cortez, if you would like to put yourself on the record, and then please keep your testimony to 5 or fewer minutes.
Hi there. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is JP Cortez, and I'm the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League, and I stand in strong support of House Bill 1, removing sales tax from gold and silver from localities and municipalities is the trend that's happening nationwide. Like Representative McCabe mentioned, 46 states as of right now, 46 states have eliminated the sales tax statewide on purchases of precious metals. That means localities, municipalities do not tax in many cases either. Like the representative said, you're exchanging one form of constitutional money for another. If you were to exchange four quarters for one paper dollar, there wouldn't be a tax on that exchange, and rightfully so, because you'd just be exchanging one form of money for another. So this bill would align further Alaska with the United States Constitution. It would enact parity between investment in precious metals and that of other financial instruments. For example, stocks, bonds, ETFs don't carry a sales tax on this purchase. So for all of that and for the arguments the Representative McCabe made, I do again stand in strong support, and I make myself available for any questions you may have. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cortez. And we will open it up to questions at this time. I also just want to note we do have Sally Cox, who's the local government specialist for Division of Community and Regional Affairs in DCCED. So she is also available. Committee member questions. Representative Holland and then Vance.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I think to our invited testifier that just spoke, I'm curious, the bill before us has really two parts. One is eliminating the sales tax on the actual purchase of the specie itself, and a second part, which is establishing specie as a legal tender for transactions. I'm curious, in the other states, you mentioned 40-some-odd more, is it common and always the case that these two changes are happening simultaneously, or do you see some states that simply exempt specie from sales tax but don't necessarily go into the additional step of creating it as a legal tender or vice versa? I'm just kind of curious about the structure and what's going on in other states here. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative, these are not necessarily happening in tandem. Like I mentioned, 46 states as of right now have eliminated the sales tax on precious metals, while the number of states that have reaffirmed gold and silver as constitutional legal tender is far less. That said, more and more states are introducing this legal tender issue as a standalone bill in many cases. The reason for that is because after having eliminated the sales tax on precious metals, a bill that symbolically reaffirms gold and silver as legal tender that doesn't cost the state anything and doesn't impose any mandates on any businesses in the state, anyone can refuse it at will. Because of that, because it's such a symbolic measure that doesn't have a ton of practical effect, many states are taking this opportunity now to pass legislation like this. I think I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention, last week, the governor of Alabama signed a bill that it didn't include the sales tax issue because Alabama had already exempted precious metals from state sales tax, but it was a symbolic legal tender bill like what's being considered here as far as the legal tender side goes. So it is something states are doing more and more of, in part because it costs the state nothing and it mandates nothing on businesses in the state.
Just follow up.
Follow up.
If I could, and as a follow up, actually, I think to the bill sponsor, I'm curious, sir, in terms of the purpose and the intent in Alaska, are these two aspects of equal importance to the folks and yourself supporting this bill, or are you primarily looking for the sales tax, but might as well get the legal tender at the same time, or is there actually an interest in Alaska of having legal tender? But you need the sales tax in order to make the legal tender more available. I'm just curious, what's the situation in Alaska? Because I'm not familiar with the demand and level of activity in this area. I'm just looking for general background.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Holland, it's Representative McCabe again. There is interest in Alaska. There is a shop in Wasilla right now that buys and sells them. There is a certain amount of interest in the prepper community, if you will, or those that want to store value in their safes. They don't necessarily want to put all of their money into a bank in buying these, but some of them are prohibited by the sales tax, or are intimidated is a better word, by the sales tax, right? I think generating the support or by having these in play is important to use them as legal tender, and as Mr. Cortez said, that's rather symbolic in the bill. I get that, but once it's in the bill, once the bill is established, there are a number of folks out there. As we saw last year, there was so many letters of support that I got some complaints from the Senate saying, please ask these guys to stop. There are a number of Alaskans that are very intensely interested in possibly using these if they need to. And think, you know, if there's a bit of a, if you think of the prepper mentality, they put these in their safe, say there's a huge run on currency or some sort of a currency problem with the United States. Now they rely on these. Now we can continue to have the economic churn in our communities because there are a group of people that now put gold and silver into play from their safes to, you know, to buy and sell goods, right? Where if you think of, I think it was, was it Argentina, I believe, that had the big economic issue in 2000, and I mean, they were using BIC lighters as currency, right? And now people that had these in their safe, or you were taking a wheelbarrow full of their money to buy a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread, well, now we would have a way to continue our commerce in the community. So long way around answering, yes, the one half of it's symbolic. Yes, the sales tax is important for folks. So
thank you.
And I put myself in the queue. I have a question. So this bill is specifically authorizing specie. So what about individuals who just have gold and silver in other forms and want to use that as currency?
So I think JP could probably answer that, but I suspect the answer is found in our Constitution, where to use it as currency, it has to have the refinement level as well as the ounces stamped on it, which is why these do. This particular one says one one-thousandth of a troy ounce of 24K gold, and I believe that has to be stamped on there. But if you wouldn't mind, I'd like JP to verify that.
Did you hear that question, Mr. Cortez?
Through the chair. Yes, ma'am, I did. Representative McCabe is correct. That's IRS rule. To qualify as, quote-unquote, good tradable gold, by law, by statute, by IRS rule, the item has to have its weight and its purity stamped on it, whether it's a coin or a bar or a a gold currency like what Representative McCabe has there. All of that has to be stamped with its weight and its purity so as to confirm its validity and its purity.
So as a follow-up, the specie that Representative McCabe has as an example is not necessarily the only kind of acceptable specie. For example, I have myself a large personal collection of troy ounces of silver that have weight stamped on them, but they're coins.
Where do you live?
They're coins. They're not almost like this paper document being passed around. So does this bill specify? I don't see in the language. It doesn't really specify, other than saying it has to be specie issued by the federal government, foreign governments, or those recognized by the U.S. Department of State. But I guess what are the parameters of what is included in this legislation? What all types of items are we talking about?
So thanks, Chair Carrick. So yes, we're talking silver coins. We're talking specie, which is the bills that Representative Holland's passing around.
No.
This way.
And, bill hasn't passed yet, Rep. Holland.
And also, so it would be Krugerrands marked as well, that sort of thing. So all of that would be considered as legal tender if it was only traded for the value of the metal that's in it at the time. If you have a collectible, so say you have a 1 ounce Roman coin that's worth $10,000, well, that's way more than the $3,500 of 1 ounce of gold, or about $3,500 spot price right now. So then it would be a collectible, and then you're talking you'd have to pay the tax on it if you were to buy it. So,
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, through the chair, to Rep. McCabe. I remember when we were talking about this bill before, and I reached out to the Department of Revenue asking, if this is something that they could use, and they said that they had no way of sort of measuring the value because the value does change and is flexible. And so your intent of the bill is voluntary of who can use it, and how do you visualize different groups using this?
Through the chair, Representative Story. So the store in Wasilla right now, he's come on in. I'm buying and selling, or I'm using goldbacks. So he's a CBD store and sort of a natural foods kind of store. And if I brought a gold back in there and said, hey, here's a $1 gold back for this $4.50 purchase, he would look up the spot price of gold and say, okay, I think that it's your $1 gold or one thousandth of an ounce of gold is worth this much money, and we will do a transaction based on that, and then he would accept the gold backs, and I would take the goods. Again, after having figured in the tax that Wasilla would owe, or that I would owe to Wasilla as well, and I would be paying that. So it is a little bit nuanced. I don't envision that the average car store is going to collect these, but I do think that there will be stores that will trade in, will use goldbacks for trade. In fact, I think that there are probably stores like this gentleman that does it in Wasilla that will probably keep those goldbacks and maybe not put them into play until they're needed, you know, just keep them as a store of value because they will be going up. Just like I think I told you, Chair Carrick, you know, if you, in the Old West, you took a $20 gold piece, 1 ounce of gold, you could buy the finest suit in the West for that one $20, 1 ounce gold piece, right? Right now, for 1 ounce of gold, $3,500, you can buy about the finest suit made. So the gold has tracked with the price of commodities, where the dollar bill has not. So it's, you're storing a portable store of value is the way I like to think of it. So hope that answered your question.
So I have a follow-up on Rep. Story's question there then. So we're in states that have specie, and in this legislation, it seems like the vision is that this would be something at a purely local level. And the example I would give is I can exchange on Venmo on an app on my phone money to another person. Venmo could charge me a tax to transfer money to that other person, or an exchange fee or something of that nature, just to transfer money from my bank account to their bank account, essentially. And that would not be the case for specie, would this bill pass. So the vision is probably that this would only look, that this could probably only be implemented at the local level, at say the small stores. Like Fred Meyer's is not going to be able to do this as a national chain, for example. Can you elaborate on
sure,
that?
Sure, Carrick. Yeah, no. Fred Meyer's probably would not want to do this, but a small local store, you could certainly take it between Anchorage. You know, if there were stores in Anchorage that accepted them, stores in Wasilla, stores in Nome, you could certainly do it that way. But I agree that Fred Meyer's probably would not do it, or Cars would probably not want to deal with the extra different currency, just like they don't want to deal with Canadian money, or they don't want to deal with Japanese yen. You know, it's just an added burden that they don't need. I totally understand that. I will tell you that former Senator Bishop and I talked a lot about a state repository that might be interested in collecting these and holding them as a store of value for the state. Texas currently has a law running for that, and many other states are considering that, almost like the state's own Fort Knox, if you will, as a sort of a bunny trail. The Chinese right now are buying gold by the pallet load to store value in China. So this is our little way of doing it, or allowing Alaskans to do it without spending a huge pile of money.
Representative Hemshoot, and then Holland.
Just a quick question that we talked about already. So thank you for having a conversation with me previously on this. It's really helped expand my understanding. My question, though, and I asked this before, is how do I know that that's 1/1,000th of a troy ounce of gold? Like, it's not regulated anywhere, so it's stamped on there, and I just have to believe. Or is there?
So maybe possibly JP's a better answer than that, but there's also there is a website, goldback.com, that talks about how the military level encryption that they use. Certainly you could weigh it, or you could take 1,000 of them and weigh them and make sure they equaled an ounce. But I think it's the same as how do you know that a $100 bill is not counterfeit? How do you know that a one-ounce gold coin is not gold-plated? You know, we run that risk all the time, not excusing it or saying it makes this any different, but I think the obviously buying it from a quality buyer, buying it from some of the online places or from goldback.com, but maybe JP has a better answer than that.
Mr. Cortez, do you want to add any comment there?
Through the chair. Sure. Yeah, I think that, like Representative McCabe mentioned, it would be incumbent on the vendor to confirm that whatever money they're accepting, be that U.S. dollars or gold or anything else, is in fact what it is purported to be. As far as testing precious metals, there are, especially today, there are a lot of ways that one could go about doing this. You can download an app on your phone that tests metals by the sound that it makes. You can buy testers that test by the specific gravity of the coin or bar. There are a lot of ways, especially today, that to confirm the validity of a gold coin or a gold bar or whatever it says it is. And any vendor, again, this wouldn't mandate anything on any individual vendor, but any vendor that chose to accept this would take steps, presumably, to ensure that that they're accepting what they think they're accepting, or that they're trading in what they think they're trading in.
Thank you.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, and I think this is a comment running up to potentially a question for DCCED or perhaps the sponsor. But first off, you know, I'm just absolutely intrigued by, you know, the knowledge that Alaska's history is rooted in gold. That's why we're here in Juneau. And I just got done hiking up the Perseverance Trail over the weekend, and a reminder of the rich, pun intended, history that gold has for our state. I grew up fascinated with the gold rushes. And that's those stories meant a lot to me and still do. And most of my career has been in mining. I've been around gold mines all across around the world over time. So I'm intrigued with the idea that Alaska should embrace gold in different ways. I'm also intrigued with the fact that currency has gotten kind of we've kind of rewritten our thoughts about it, particularly with the advent of all the Bitcoin. We've now kind of virtualized currency to the point where it's a thing that we can't see, touch. We put it into some sort of thing called a wallet, but you can't pull it out of your pocket, and you can lose it and lose the value forever. And we've accepted Bitcoin, a virtual thing, as a currency that's been accepted around the world now, with some concerns about it being an alternative way of doing transactions that aren't tracked very well. But nonetheless, it is now part of the world. And from an entrepreneurial perspective, it's really opened up a lot of new doors for business models. So that's a roundabout way of saying, and I think the question maybe is to DCCED, if we still have somebody there, or perhaps a sponsor, how does Alaska deal with something virtual in currency like Bitcoin? And is there really anything related to specie that isn't actually far more tangible, practical, and useful than Bitcoin and other things? Because at the end of the day, we could take a specie, a coin, and there's still real gold there. And I've long thought that Bitcoin cryptocurrency was the weirdest thing imaginable. And the idea that you could actually, you know, hold the real value, not the representation of value like a dollar is, as, you know, a more fundamental way to do that. So I'm curious about cryptocurrency without going too far off the deep end. But is this really doing anything different than what we maybe already allow in other areas of currency?
Big question, Representative Holland.
They're referred to as Holland or Kai questions in other circles, so sorry.
I guess we'll let our DCCD Representative Sally Cox, if you would like to chime in on that. I think that's probably actually more of a question for the invited testifier, but we'll see what she says. Did you hear that question?
Yes, this is I did. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you. This is Sally Cox. I'm the local government specialist with DCRA. Through the chair to Representative Holland,
I don't have an answer to that question, but I will be happy to go back to my division and query my fellow colleagues and find an answer for you and get back to you on that.
Thank you, Ms. Cox. And we'll ask our invited testifier, Mr. Cortez, if you have a comment there.
Through the chair. Representative, thank you for the question. This bill specifically, House Bill 1, doesn't do anything on Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. And the reason, and it specifically addresses constitutional money, gold and silver, the only form of money mentioned in the Constitution, and that is not an accident. Like you mentioned, some of the shortcomings of Bitcoin, right, where the digital nature of it, the intangible nature of it, make it riskier than what we've known money to be for thousands of years. Counterparty risk is the term for what is essentially a liability, which is what the U.S. Federal Reserve note is. It's an IOU paper note. It's someone else's debt. Whereas gold and silver are the final extinguishers of debt. It is actual money. The founders of the United States knew that, and that's why they wrote about the perils of paper money, and a lot of those same arguments could be applied to the cryptos of the world that are, you know, this is internet money. And so for the same reason that the Federal Reserve note has these shortcomings, a lot of the crypto, this sort of imagined digital money, suffers from those same shortcomings as well. And that's why the importance of gold and silver being mentioned in the Constitution. You mentioned Alaska having a very rich history in gold. And like I mentioned, this is a national trend. It's not just sales tax. It's not just legal tender. There are states earlier this year, Wyoming established a multi-million-dollar physical gold reserve that they're storing in their state. And Tennessee is considering this. Utah just did it as well. And so this is all speaking to kind of a reimagining of money. States are looking at their balance sheets and realizing that a lot of it is U.S. dollar-denominated debt in many cases that has real negative rates of return. And gold and silver historically have held their value. And at this time where there's a shaking in the public confidence of the dollar, monetary policy is becoming a little different. This tariff policy is raising questions. And countries all over the world, like was mentioned earlier, are stockpiling gold, because it is a non-political money that has held its value for thousands of years. And that's why this legislation here is promoting gold and silver, ultimately allowing people more easily to adopt their own gold standard if they choose to do so.
Representative McCabe.
So thanks. If you really study history, the beginning of a demise of any dynasty is when they start down the fiat currency road, when their currency is backed by nothing except the full faith and benevolence of the government, right? And so this actually makes the gold that used to back our currency before various presidents got involved something we keep right in our pocket instead of in Fort Knox somewhere. So that's if you really get into the prepper mentality, and if you really get into the sound money defense mentality, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is make our money tangibly the gold that used to be backing our U.S. currency. So that's, and this is, I mean, that's the big global overarching idea. This is just a really small piece of that. So,
okay. I have an additional question. I know we talked about this a bit, but while gold and silver both have, over time, relatively stable value, to your example, on a day-to-day basis, they can fluctuate really wildly. So I'm still kind of hung up on the how is a merchant going to decide what that value is on a given day, knowing that even the very next day, it could be $2 or $3 more or less in value than it was the day previously. And I guess, how have other states navigated that kind of merchant discretion and not gotten into big arguments with their customers? Because I could see customers being really upset with being told, oh, today your specie is worth $5 more than it was yesterday, or $5 less.
Sure, Chair Carrick. So I think anybody that's using this understands the limitations of it. Just like, you know, I used to do a lot of international travel, and when I would go to China, and you go to the counter of the hotel there, and it says, today, U.S. dollar is worth so many yuan, or RMB, right? And that was just their rate. That's what they would accept. And you just kind of, if you wanted to change to the local currency, that was the deal. And you could try to negotiate with them all you want, but the manager in the morning set the price based on what he saw on the internet or called on the phone, and that was the deal. So I think the people that are using Goldback or specie are in the same boat, and I think they would all recognize that. There might be a discussion, sure, there might be some bartering, but there's oftentimes bartering when you're buying stuff. Well, maybe not in the U.S., but everywhere else in the world there's bartering usually involved. So I maybe didn't answer your question, but that's the way I would envision. In fact, there's apps that actually do that. You know, you pull up an app and you say the price of gold is this, Kevin, you know, so let's, if you want to buy my goods for this price, that's with using specie, that's where it's at.
So a domestic currency that works really similarly functionally to a foreign currency, in that most vendors probably won't accept it. The amount changes on a regular basis. Okay. I appreciate the explanation. Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you. I went to a museum in Virginia that had the history of the debate of bringing the greenback and the danger of having a note. It is a fiscal note. Our money is paper. It's not real. It is a promissory note. And I think we have failed to recognize that. The value of our dollar fluctuates all day long, but we don't think about it that way. And that's why we have inflation. It's that thief in the night, because we're not failing to recognize that the dollar is fluctuating on a regular basis. However, when you have gold or silver specie, the greenback or the coin or whatever, that value is what you have in your hand. It's not the promissory note. And I think that's the value of it. I look at the price that we paid for my wedding bands when we got married 22 years ago. They are worth triple what we paid for them, and the value's only increased. So this to me is definitely the right move, because people can feel that the money that they've earned is secure. It's not going to lose value. It's actually in their hand. But I do have a question. My question is, could this help the cannabis industry? Because they're kind of in the pickle with being able to deposit the dollar, right? Is this something that could help those businesses who choose to participate?
Through the chair, 100%, because you don't really need a bank. I mean, the cannabis industry is struggling because you can't put money in the bank, right? Mm-hmm. That's where they would store their money, or they put it in a closet and have closets full of $100 bills. This you can put in a safe as gold, and you don't really need to put it in a bank, and it continues to store value and accrues the same or better return than putting $10,000 in a bank and getting 2% or 1% for a year or a quarter, whatever they're paying. The gold maintains its value and accrues more value. And Chair Carrick, sort of to your point, yes, there's minor daily fluctuation, but if I was a merchant and I was accepting goldbacks, which I would immediately do, I would be stashing every single one of them into my safe when somebody came, because I realize that gold is a fabulous store of value. And so I'll be the first one if I ever become an entrepreneur.
Follow up. Representative McCabe, and you're probably going to kick me later for asking this, but why didn't you include the next piece of this that allows, that gives the authority for the state to make the repository so that the value of people's gold or silver can be used on the debit, like what Texas is doing.
Through the chair, thanks. So you're talking about the transactional piece.
Yes.
And so that is a piece that I just felt this was enough of a leap for Alaskans and for us as a legislature that I want to get this piece in place first. So the transactional bit is, it's another bunny trail, but it is a repository right now that you put gold into. You buy the gold with dollars or your bank electronic transfer, and they actually put physical gold in a repository with your name on it. And then you spend via a credit card off of that gold. So the money that you keep in that repository, the gold that you keep in there, is not losing value like your electronic money that you keep in a bank in dollars is losing value. And you can spend it on a credit card. But I just felt like that was a bit more complicated than I wanted to do right now. I know.
You're... It sweetens the pot, man.
Always make an amendment, Representative Vance.
Well, I wanted to wet their, like, tickle their fancy a little bit on... On the transactional piece, I think it's very practical because someone has a debit that's easily usable for a piece of gum or something, right? I don't know if anybody chews gum anymore, but it's a smaller, like, you can use it for whatever where you don't have to have the gold back, and it makes it where more merchants can participate. So that's why I asked. It feels like it to me, it's the selling point of everything. And it, you know, the fact that others are doing it is pretty phenomenal, but I'm just amazed that Alaska moved away from using gold and silver as legal specie because of our history. Do you have any insight as to when that happened? Is it when we became a state? I mean, when did we stop using gold?
Through the chair, yeah, so that's a JP's probably better equipped to answer that, but certainly there's two presidents that affected our gold supply. There's actually three. There's one that put us on the gold standard. There's one that took us off the gold standard, and there's one that basically sold all our gold, I think. But JP would probably be better equipped to answer that.
Mr. Cortez?
Through the chair. I think most recently, as far as cutting the final tie to gold, that would have been Nixon in the 70s officially closing the gold window in 1971, making that the U.S. dollar was formally convertible. You used to be able to go to a bank. Countries used to be able to go to the United States and tell them, I would like to trade these Federal Reserve notes for ounces of gold. And they would make that exchange. And then in 1971, Nixon said, we're not doing that anymore. And since then, we've been on an entirely paper currency. And the results of that were pretty much what we expected. You have exploding deficits. You have endless wars. You have a bureaucratic state that continues to grow. So the paper money experiment went like that of all the other paper money experiments that have happened throughout history. The government grows, and then eventually the money dies. So this legislation would be an attempt to mitigate that damage. Of course, we know that the damage, the monetary dysfunction that we're living through comes from the Federal Reserve and the Federal Branch, the Federal Branch, but there are things states can do to mitigate some of this damage. So this would be a good first step for Alaska to take. And then hopefully one day, when you get into further talking about creating state depositories, enabling state treasurers to invest state funds in pension funds or reserve funds, transactional pieces, things like that. That's all stuff that states that have already eliminated this tax, that have already taken this first step, have taken subsequent steps forward. But many states start with legislation like this, just to whet the appetite, to understand why gold is important, why maybe the state should hold it, and generally why the state should enable or at least not impede people from investing and saving in gold and silver if they choose.
So we have to wrap up here in just a moment, but I wanted to try to get this down to brass tacks as much as possible. Gold tacks.
Gold backs.
So a private entity produces the species, say, like Florida Goldbacks, or does the state produce it? I have a few questions here.
Thanks. And Chair Carrick, once again, JP could probably answer that better than I could. But, yes, a private entity usually produces it, and it is sponsored from the way I understand by the state. So those ones I passed around are the latest ones that are just done in Florida. Most states, Florida is a little bit different. Florida actually put those out before they had the law in place. They were running the law like we're doing right now in place, and they put those out sponsored by the state. So it's a little bit fluid right now, and I think, JP, I know we got limited time here, but maybe JP can answer that in a few words.
Mr. Cortez.
Through the chair. Yes. So in the case of Goldbacks, what Representative McCabe has there, that is a private company that's making these. They're not minted by the state. I will say that the state of Tennessee is currently considering legislation to actively mint things like Goldbacks. But as far as what this legislation pertains to, that's going to be more the IRS classification, which would include things like Goldbacks, things like privately minted coins or privately minted rounds or bars that are, again, stamped with their weight and purity. But this would also include government minted coins. The U.S. Mint produces a gold eagle and a silver eagle and a buffalo, for example. The Canadian Royal Mint produces the maple leaf. The Australian Mint produces the kangaroo, and so on and so forth. So this would also apply to government-minted, U.S.-minted items as well. So it wouldn't just be the privately minted things, but those would be included as well.
Okay, and just a follow-up, I think, last question here. Alaska also has a very long history of bartering and exchanging goods for other goods. And there's nothing in state law that prohibits that, to my understanding. So right now, gold and silver is treated essentially as a good as opposed to a tender. So you can currently exchange it for another good, say a gallon of milk. Why is it important to have this legislation as opposed to like the current status quo, where as an Alaskan, I can go to my friend Rep Himshute's house and say, hey, I'd like to buy that bicycle. This is what I'm exchanging for it. Instead of another bicycle, it's some troy ounces of silver. Why is it important to have this be a recognized legal tender as opposed to how folks might be exchanging this currently?
Sure, Chair Carrick. So I think it's because of the portability and the storability, and it's also because of what Representative Himshute, exactly what she said. Now we have a physical thing that we can compare to their drawing with their, and says this is actually 1/1000th of a troy ounce of 24 karat gold, because it says it right there. It's got a serial number. The drawing matches. I mean, the artwork matches that, and you can store it in your safe where you can't store many of the things we barter. Necessarily in a safe, unless you have diamonds or that sort of thing, and those are even more difficult to determine the value of. So these particular species, the goldbacks that I had, or the Krugerrands, or the $20 gold pieces, the golden eagles, are pretty easy to store, and they're pretty easy to determine that they're actually what they say they are, and I think that's the difference between, you know, bartering. And you could certainly, I mean, you could use them now. The store in Wasilla, you can buy and sell them there if you want. But they're not Alaskan. And one of my dreams is to see somebody invest in making these in Alaska. And, picture of, I don't know if it's Denali or McKinley, whatever the mountain is. Or a dog sled team, or Elizabeth Paratrovich. Somebody, Senator Rivak wanted to send it to the Alaska Arts Council and have a contest on drawing for the fronts of the goldback. So I can imagine this could be a boon for Alaska in many ways, but the biggest one for my concern is being able to store portable value cheaply and easily.
Okay, thank you. We do have to wrap up.
Can I just make one final note? I'm so sorry. You asked the question about why it's important to do this, and Representative McCabe gave a great answer, but I just wanted one last point. The reason is, on top of the symbolic, the state of Alaska embracing gold and that being important to the mining industry and dealers in the state and such, declaring gold and silver legal tender offers contractual protections in the case of a contract denominated in gold and silver. So if you were to not pass this, if you and I were to go into a contract that extended over 30 years and we agreed that I'm going to paint your house and you're going to pay me in gold and silver, and we end up having a dispute that has to go to court, a judge can say, okay, I find in favor of J.C., but you have this contract denominated in gold and silver. That's not legal tender. We're going to choose that the specific performance that's called for here is payable in U.S. legal tender, that being Federal Reserve notes. We're trying to make sure that that doesn't happen because we're saying that gold and silver and the U.S. Federal Reserve note are not substitutes. So to make sure that in the case of contractual protections, in the case of contracts denominated in gold and silver, we want to make sure that that is the specific performance called for there is, in fact, legal tender gold and silver.
Okay. Thank you for that. I think that we'll have to conclude our hearing today on House Bill 1. We are going to set this bill aside. I would like to try to bring this bill back before the committee before the end of the session this year. So please be thinking about additional questions for the bill sponsor during that time. Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Thanks.
So that concludes House State Affairs for today. Our next meeting is on Thursday, May 1st at 3:15 here in Room 120. The current agenda for that meeting is as follows. Consideration of the governor's appointee to the Alaska Police Standards Council, Timothy Collins. Then we will have an introductory hearing on House Bill 24 on aggravating factors at sentencing from Representative Josephson. We will also take public testimony and continue our discussion on House Bill 152, the education head tax bill from Representative Galvin, and take up amendments on House Joint Resolution 10, the constitutional POMV from Representative Shragi. With no further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 5:10 p.m.